for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. China has drawn global attention for its double-digit economic growth and its increasing influence in world affairs. A new book by two China experts explores the pillars of China's evolving society and its impact on the world. It's titled China's Megatrends, and John and Doris Nesbitt join me in the studio. You know John Nesbitt as the author of the bestseller Megatrends. He's former Assistant Secretary of Education under the John F. Kennedy administration and Special Assistant to LBJ, a former visiting fellow at Harvard. Doris Nesbitt is director of the Nesbitt China Institute and a professor at Yunnan University. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. And you can join us on Twitter and Facebook. Good morning to both of you. How good to have you here.
Well, it's our pleasure. It's great to be here with you, Diane.
Thank you.
Good morning.
And
very
happy
nice.
New Year.
Thank you. Same to you.
Now, this book on China really takes my breath away because you have found how extraordinary their growth has been, but also how they think ahead. What's happening, John?
Well, we wrote the book Inside Out. Most of the books about China are outside in. And we tried to get inside China, and I've been going to China for 42 years, and Doris and I have been going there last 10 years. And we tried to write this China story from the Chinese point of view. And it's extraordinary what happened when Deng Xiaoping became the leader. And the first thing he did was to say and to talk about how the Chinese people had to move from indoctrination to emancipation of the mind, to liberate them so they could think for themselves and they could make their own contributions to the country. And that energized China, energized the people of China, not all at once, but by one step by step, to create this wonderful, amazing journey from dirt poor to this year will be the second largest economy in the world.
But, Doris, despite that extraordinary growth, isn't there still a great deal of poverty in the country?
You are right. There still is poverty in the country. You know, on one hand, more than 400 million came out of poverty, and it was a poverty we cannot imagine. I mean, they really did not know what to feed their children with. The working people, the peasants, had no hope because there was no way in climbing up the social ladder. So 400 million came out of poverty, but as you say, in the provinces, in the rural areas, of course, the progress, economic progress, has not had the same speed as it had in the cities we all know.
And, of course, we're talking about a country of a billion people. So when you say 400 million have risen from poverty, how did the government manage to get that growth going?
The government didn't do it. Deng Xiaoping realized that he couldn't do it and the government couldn't do it. He had to liberate the people so they could make their contribution and not simply be told what to do all the time and what their job would be and so on. It was the people who did it.
It's fascinating because you and your wife, Doris, identify eight pillars as the foundation and drivers of China's new society. And you say that emancipation of the mind is the foundation of these other pillars. Now, how does one go about emancipating one's mind?
We have a friend, a Chinese man whose family was dirt poor. The mother was bringing up her children to have them all study under the, you know, biggest sacrifices she could do. And she said a sentence to her children, which impressed us a lot. She said, "Only when you step out of the field, you can see the mud on your feet." And that was what Deng Xiaoping, with emancipating the mind, allowed the Chinese to do. They were allowed to see the facts in which they, the conditions in which they lived in, and he also gave them the opportunity to change the conditions they lived in. He started to open the doors to the schools again. During the Cultural Revolution, education, as you know, was limited to very few people. It was sort of banned. And people could, there was no way to improve your life. But to look at, to open your eyes again, to look at where are we, what can we do, that was the initial fire that made the Chinese then make their single steps.
And of course, what's fascinating here is that what we in the West hear most about has been China's single child policy, China's limitation of freedom of thought, of communication. Yesterday or today, there was an article in the LA Times saying that the internet was opened briefly as the Great Firewall came down. So what we're hearing is quite contrary to apparently what you have seen.
Well, Diane, I think the big hurdle here is the Communist Party of China, the name, the Communist Party of China. We in the West tend to take that as the Communist Party, as it was in Russia, as it was in China, as it was in the Eastern Bloc, and so on. Well, the Communist Party of China is not the Communist Party it used to be. The name is the same, just as with the Republicans. The name is the same, but, you know, we could think of all kinds of names, I'm sure, that we could call the Republicans because they've changed so much, but still the Republican Party. This is the Communist Party, but there are no communists there. We haven't met any communists. The furthest they go is to say that they're the socialists with Chinese characteristics, which means that we're socialists, but our definition of socialist is what is paramount, and their definition is market economy socialist, which is, of course, an oxymoron if there ever was one. But it's not the Communist Party that we all have in mind.
So what you're saying is that we here in the West may be getting a somewhat distorted view?
You know, In a discussion in China, which was also recorded on TV, I said the question was, why is the recording in the West so negative? And I think it is, if we picture the world as a big neighborhood, and there are all the established neighbors, and there is one new neighbor coming in. And this neighbor upgrades his house, you know, constantly. So what do all the others do? What's the most interesting? Gossip. And what is the most interesting in gossip? Negative things, of course. Oh, have you seen what he did? And did you see this and that? And some of it is quite justified. But some of it is simply gossip. So if we take that picture of the neighborhood, then China is this new neighbor who has moved on the stage of the world and is getting wealthier and wealthier and more self-confident every year.
And more gossip about it.
And more gossip about it. But as Doris says, some of that gossip is certainly true and justified. However, what you are seeing from your inside-out reporting is that there is tremendous change going on in China.
Well, the great change that the Chinese people experience is social change. The fathers of all of the young Chinese people and their grandfathers all were told what job they would have. They would have that job for life. They could never leave it. If they got married, they had to get the permission of the plant manager or the communist or the party secretary. And they could never get divorced. Their social life, everything, they couldn't go to the university if they wanted to. Only those that were chosen by the party could go. Their whole social life was restricted and controlled. That is now all gone. The social and personal freedoms in China are as open as they are in the Western world. The political freedoms are a little different, although they're not quite what they are described in the West. But you have to the Chinese people concentrate and focus on the incredible change in their social freedom and their individual freedom that they have today.
Now, that social freedom still does not include freedom to use the internet, freedom to use.
Well, of course. There are more internet users in China than any other country in the world. There are 350 million internet users, and you would be amazed to read what's on the internet. The criticism of the government, mostly it's about personal things as it is on the internet in this country or wherever, but a lot of criticism. There is a red line where they can't step beyond, but most of it's about personal things.
John and Doris Nesbitt, their new book is titled China's Megatrends, The Eight Pillars of a New Society. And welcome back. John and Doris Nesbitt are with me. You certainly know John Nesbitt's name from his earlier mega successful book titled Megatrends. Now the two are looking at China's megatrends and what they define as the eight pillars of a new society. If you'd like to join us, call us on 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Your pillar three talks about setting frames. And I wonder how successful you think that has been in terms of China's economic growth, Doris.
Well, there are two ways of looking at a frame. You can see it as a limitation, or you can see it as a protected area in which you can act and do whatever you do. And the Chinese tend to see these frames as a protecting area in which they can do whatever they do, because here comes an advantage of the Chinese political system. There is a constancy in the government. So their thinking is not election-driven, but long-term driven. And they are able to set long-term goals in which, and with the long-term goals, create the frames in which then the people can act. And the Chinese government gives the people all the freedom they need to grow. That's why we use the metaphor of the trees that grow within the forest. Mm.
John, just before the break, you were saying how many people use the internet. The LA Times said that yesterday, for a couple of hours, the Chinese government's web censoring system, known as the Great Firewall, was lifted. And suddenly, internet users had access to websites that had been banned for months, such as YouTube, Facebook, and Twitter. Why does the government ban the use of those sites?
Well, because they think there are things on the websites that are not don't contribute to the stability of the country. But interestingly, the big push is against pornography. Overwhelmingly, the ban is on pornography, and it's very strongly supported by the people. There are a lot of considerations about this, and it's a very complicated matter. But the government does ban and intervene in pornography and in challenges to the leadership of China, not to criticisms about corruption, which you find all over the internet, especially local corruption, criticisms about the environment and what's not being done. That's all over the press in China, all over the internet, things that you wouldn't imagine were there, but they're there. But the Chinese government draws the line against people who want to challenge the leadership of the government. That's where the red line is.
How much corruption do you see?
Oh, it's incredibly widespread. And President Hu has been talking about it for a long time. All the leaders talk about it.
What kind of corruption?
Take bribes, mostly, taking money for doing favors.
Why aren't those leaders simply removed?
Well, the leaders are removed. And people, and as we've seen, those leaders that are corrupt are often executed. And we complain about that as well. But they've got a big corruption problem there, and they set some pretty impressive examples about what trouble you can get to if you. As far as we can tell, the top leadership, the top leadership, is not corrupt, but certainly locally in the provinces and in the cities and towns, there's a lot of corruption still, just as there is in any country, in every country in this world, but a lot more in China than in other places.
So, do you believe that the Western press is unfairly criticizing China because of those elements we've already talked about, the restrictions on the internet, the use of capital punishment, the manner in which they deal with all kinds of problems, very personal problems, Doris?
There are two sides of it. Partly, the criticism is justified. But it is, as with many things, you know, if you only look at the dark side and at the negative things, just imagine if in China only the negative things about the U.S. are reported. Then the picture you get from the United States will be a very different one. So I think that the real problem is that there is not enough balance in the reporting about China. It is okay to show that here is a violation of human rights, but it should also be shown that, look, what China has achieved and what people can do and how much freedom there is. Because if China would be so terrible, why would 470, correct me, John, if I'm wrong, of the American top 500 countries are companies are in China? Why do so many people see a chance? Why do so many Western people start moving to China? Because, not because it's such a terrible country, but it is emerging as a country of opportunities.
Washington Post staff writer John Pumphrey wrote on Sunday that the U.S. and China are headed for a rough patch. He said this would happen in the early months of the new year as the White House appears set to sell a package of weapons to Taiwan and as President Obama plans to meet the Dalai Lama. Now, you...
those are two sticks in the eyes of the Chinese. I mean, you couldn't pick two areas that would antagonize and upset the Chinese more than Taiwan and Tibet. And why the government would do that, I don't know. I'm not sure that the patch is going to be as bad as just reported. They're so sensitive and they're so awkward about the Chinese and how they respond to criticism. They still don't have the confidence of a country that's been in the position the U.S. has for so many decades. But that will come, presumably. But they handle it quite badly.
When you say they, of course, you're talking about the Chinese leadership.
Right.
But what about the Chinese people themselves? How are they in terms of their enjoyment of life? You talked about the 400 million who have risen from poverty. Describe their lives now as opposed to what they were, Doris.
I am European. So I was always seeing the United States as the country where you can make your dreams come true. And I always admired the U.S. And I always thought that China is, you know, quite a different case.
A backward country.
Which it was.
And yes. But from the time when I started to go there, and that's since the year 2000, you could really feel what you can feel in the U.S., a pride about your motherland, a pride about your own country, and a confidence about the fact that this is the country where you can make your dreams come true. And this is, you know, we had so many interviews with young people, and the most of the journalists are very young in China because, you know, that's the generation which has the freedom to ask. The old ones were more stiff. But in the questions the young people put you, you can feel that feeling of, we Chinese can do it too.
Give me an example.
They say in America you can become anything, but now we in China can choose what we want to do. How do you see that, and why does the West not write about it? It is kind of a look. We are here and we love our country. We know that we are not as free as Americans to express your opinion if you disagree heavily with something. But we are on the way. What can we do to stay on this path and to be successful on this path in a way? Of course, China wants to be the next America.
The next America.
I don't mean replacing America.
No, I understand. No, but
I think that we're moving toward the American dream is kind of shifting to the Chinese dream. One of the things you talk about, the 400 million coming out of poverty, but what you have to talk about also is the millions and millions, hundreds of millions of people moving into what we would call middle class. And there are more Chinese students studying abroad than ever in the history of China. And most of them are coming back. and
coming back
to China,
China after studying here. Why?
Well, because, and as a matter of fact, those who went earlier in early days, and went to the U.S. and then stayed in the U.S. are now coming back. We call them the sea turtles. They're returning because the opportunities in China are now greater than the opportunities in the West. That's clear. We've seen it everywhere.
Give me an example.
Well, the entrepreneurs who have been involved in the new technologies, in biotech, in robotics, in all those, so many of them now are seeing that China is so open to that, and China is pushing so hard to become an innovative country. Everyone wants to become an innovative country, but China is really doing something to make that possible for China.
I was fascinated to read that China is working on a high-speed train that, while the United States has allocated $13 billion for high-speed rail over the next 5 years, China plans to spend $300 billion in the next decade to build the world's most expensive, extensive, and advanced high-speed rail.
Well, let me put it this way. China is in the process of building a countrywide network of bullet trains, and they've already gone a long ways. We live in Tianjin, which is about now 30 minutes by bullet train from Beijing. We ride it a lot, so we know these trains. They're modern, marvelous trains, but they're creating a network in all of China, connecting the great cities and sections of China with bullet trains. At the same time, in America, we're still got trains running at the speeds that they were running 100 years ago.
I mean, that really takes my breath away, that they are devoting that much of their resources, that they can afford to devote that much of their resources. John and Doris Nesbitt are with me. Their new book is titled China's Mega Trends, The Eight Pillars of a New Society. And you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. Why did you move to China, John?
Because that's where the great story of the world today is. The great story of the world is how China has risen in just 30 years, in just one generation, from such a poverty-stricken, backward country to becoming the second largest economy in the world this year, and a country that's moving towards leadership in the new technologies, in biotech and so on, because that's where the opportunities are.
And the two of you were married in the year 2000. Were you married in China or here in the United States?
Well, we continued to be married as we traveled in China, but we were married in Austria.
You were married in Austria, and you were happy to go to China and live, Doris?
My love for China came slowly, I must say. But once the virus really caught me, I was so interested in finding out what's really going on. And, you know, we talk about China, and that is as if we talk about, you know, something big. But what we see is the people. You know, China is not just, you know, one monolith. It's 1.3 billion people, each person with his and her own story. And it is so fascinating. We talk to people of all kinds, you know, not only to academics and politicians, but to people who have minor jobs, to drivers and workers. And what is in common is that they all look forward. They do not look back. They look forward and they see what chances they have. And, you know, from Europe, you are used to people whining and blaming everybody, the government, the country, the neighbor, the weather, the boss.
But surely you're not saying that the people of China are not complaining.
Oh, they are complaining. They are, you know, they can be very angry about things. But they don't say, oh, I cannot achieve this because my neighbor is doing this or the government is doing that. They look for what can I do and how can I move something. And that is something that I think is responsible for the progress that China makes, that the people look at themselves and say, okay, here I have this opportunity. What can I do with it?
John and Doris Nesbitt, their new book is titled China's Mega Trends, The Eight Pillars of a New Society. We'll take a short break. When we come back, we'll open the phones. I look forward to hearing your questions and comments.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the Annie E. Casey Foundation, promoting lifelong family connections for children and youth, on the web at aecf.org. By the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, your source for what works in public education. Learn more at edutopia.org. And by the Ford Foundation, working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide at fordfoundation.org. This is NPR.
John Oliver is a correspondent on Comedy Central's The Daily Show with Jon Stewart. Even if you don't recognize the name, you probably recognize the voice, and Oliver has used it to good comic advantage.
Deep down, Americans still can't help but respect the British accents. It's something latent in your history, in our history, that you still can't help but respect the authority of this voice.
John Oliver on the next Fresh Air.
John and Doris Nesbitt are with me. Their new book titled China's Mega Trends, The Eight Pillars of a New Society, has become a bestseller in China, a bestseller in Taiwan, and I have the feeling quite soon a bestseller in the United States. Let's open the phones now. We'll go to Orlando, Florida. Good morning, Joe. You're on the air.
Good morning. Listen, I believe it's indisputable that the communist Chinese government has harnessed the ingenuity and the work ethic of the Chinese people to accomplish perhaps an unprecedented advance in their economy, in world history, perhaps. However, with all due respect, I do believe that you are painting too rosy a picture regarding the social freedom that the people have. I particularly am concerned about the religious liberty in China. I think it's a fact that the government controls all of the churches. They must have government permission to build a building or to even exist. And also, I'm very concerned about the democratic liberty in China. May perhaps there have been some improvements. However, recently, just a month ago, the advocate, most renowned advocate, I believe his name is Li, in China for democratic reform, and basically he's just advocating, perhaps thinking about political parties, etc., was sentenced to 18 years in prison just for speaking those ideas. And this is very similar to what's going on in Cuba. So there seems to be some contradiction here where we don't do any business with Cuba and we accept China in the world community.
All right, Joe, let's hear what John Nesbitt has to say.
I wonder if the caller has ever been to China.
No, I haven't.
Well, your picture doesn't coincide with ours who live in China and talk to people and deal with people all the time. But let me say about Liu, the person you talked about, was just sentenced. He was sentenced not for speaking his opinion, because that's done all over China all the time. He was sentenced because he was organizing an alternative government. He was getting petitions. He had 10,000 signatures to have another. Although there are other parties in China, this was a party to install multiple elections and so forth. He crossed the line that all Chinese know that if you cross the line, then you take the consequences. He's well known because he's one of the few dissidents who remains in China. And he's very courageous to do that. And he remains in China, so he's taking his medicine. But you can't take this one case and generalize, as the Western press has, that suddenly China, the government, is doing a big crackdown on political dissidents. They are not. This is a very specific case, and there'll be other specific cases that come along, but they don't constitute a countrywide crackdown. We don't see that at all.
All right. To Elkridge, Maryland. Good morning, Tim.
Good morning, Ms. Rehm, and Woman Howe to our guest. I'm reminded of standing in Tiananmen Square and asking an old man how he liked Chairman Mao. Looking at the picture, he spat on the ground. And then a young teenage girl right next to me, I asked her about Chairman Mao. She said, oh, he's the hero of the nation. There's a wide diversity of opinions over there. My quick statement, in 2003, I had the honor to be the English editor for the Chinese government's Science Progress in China, a 50-year perspective. And what struck me was the impressive advanced state of Chinese scientific and engineering in many fields, a condition that was radically shattered by the Cultural Revolution. I sense both a strong resentment of this historic calamity and an inferiority complex that's pervasive within the leadership. So my question is, how do you believe these underpinnings affect the Chinese drive to replace the U.S. as the world power? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Well, I'm not sure the goal is to replace the U.S. as a world power, but I think your assessment of China is really pretty much right on. I don't know, maybe you want to add something to that.
I would come back to how we look at China and to the religious question also. You know, China is about to become the has the goal to become the innovation nation of the world. And to do that, they need Western knowledge, and they know that. So what they do now is they create centers. How do you call those?
High-tech parks.
High-tech parks. My mother language is not English. High-tech parks. And what they know is that to attract people from the West whom they need, they also have to create an environment which the West wants, including churches. So the Chinese are very smart. They know their lacks, and you were talking about an inferiority complex. The self-confidence or the lack of self-confidence in certain parts is part of the reason why the Chinese overreact to criticism, whether it comes from the West or whether it comes from inside China.
Interesting.
I want to follow up that caller, a very interesting question. China, as we said a couple times, is becoming the second largest economy in the world. But we've got to put that in perspective. That's going to be about $5 trillion GDP, $5 trillion. But the U.S. economy is $14 trillion. I mean, that's a long stretch up to number one. However, GDP is a collective figure, so we're not going to all stand around and wait until it catches up, because in the meantime, it is emphasizing the science and the innovation in areas that it is at the same starting line, and that's biotechnology and robotics and all those new technologies where they're emphasizing in their development.
Here's an email from Jerry Smith in Westminster, Maryland. He says the way to understand today's China is to think of it as a gigantic American-style corporation. At the top is a board of directors with Hu as the CEO, and they have a huge non-unionized but money-motivated workforce. They are destined to eat our lunch.
Well, except for the last, that's a very good description. But
well, we exactly use this picture to make it a little more understandable how China structured its economic recovery. It is, and we compare Deng Xiaoping to a CEO who gets a moribund company which is on the brink of bankruptcy. So what does he do? He has to, first of all, encourage his workforce to make it a common goal to sit in the same boat with him to really get the company going again. And, you know, there are very funny things when Cheng Ruimin, who runs Haier, which is now one of the biggest companies in the world, multinational company, and, you know, when he came into the company which he took over, it was a different name then, he said, at 10 o'clock, you could have thrown a hand grenade into the factory and nobody would have been hurt because all the workers were gone. You had to have a sign on the wall that it's forbidden to
urinate
on the grounds. It was so desolate that one day he was forcing the workmen to use a sledgehammer to ruin all the damage, all the refrigerators they had made. And one refrigerator was the salary of 2 years of a workman. So, you know, it was not, it really needed to put up your sleeves and get things going.
Here's a caller in New Haven, Connecticut. Good morning, Ted. You're on the air.
Really needed to put up your
sleeves. Hello, Ted. Are you there?
In New Haven.
All right. Let's go to Phoenix, Arizona. Good morning, Jordan.
Hi, Diane. Thanks for having me on.
Sure.
My question for your guest is, well, first of all, I can appreciate your perspective as someone who's lived in China. And also, I just want to ask, 50 years down the road from now, what do you guys think will be some of the major differences that will have taken place in China?
John?
Well, I think the direction is firmly set for the incredible expansion of the middle class. And because, you know, the GDP per capita in China is 1/14 of what it is in the U.S. I mean, they've got such a long ways to go. And I think that our guess is that they've realized about a third of the way in their journey to becoming a really modern society. And then we will end up with, you know, China and the U.S. being the two dominant countries, but at a time when, in the meantime, we will be turning the globe into one economy. Just one economy for the whole world. We'll be so economically integrated that the old ways of looking at things will not do anymore.
Here's an email from Lonnie, who's in Peterborough, New Hampshire, who says the violently oppressed Tibetans, Falun Gong, and Uyghurs would beg to differ with the Nesbitts about opportunity in the new China.
I would ask if the caller has been to Tibet.
Well, I'm reading from an email.
Oh, from an email.
Yes.
I would email back and say, we've been there. It is not an oppressed area. In fact, it's a Lhasa, where the capital of Tibet is a very modern city, a very thriving city, and the Tibetans, the monks, and so on, are subsidized actually by the Chinese government.
You know, what is not very much known in the West is how the Tibetan society was before 1949, before the Chinese came. It was a feudal society. 95% of the population were serfs, and the rest were the aristocrats, an aristocratic class, and the monks, and they were in power. So life was not a paradise in Tibet, only for 5% of the population.
What about Falun Gong and the Uyghurs? What comments would you make?
Well, Falun Gong is, in the Chinese view, the Chinese government's view, not a religion, but a cult. A distinction that they make and that has been made in other countries
but
as
so
well.
But so what?
No, so what? So they are somehow a threat. We don't understand it. We in the West, and Doris and I don't quite understand why Falun Gong is such a threat. But they perceive it as a threat, and they have outlawed it in China. They don't outlaw it in their view. They're not outlawing it as a religion, but as an organized threat to their leadership.
We're talking about a new book titled China's Mega Trends, with the authors John and Doris Nesbitt, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. And to Cincinnati, Ohio, good morning, Donald. You're on the air.
Show. It's great to be on. I'd like to ask the Nesbitts, two questions, but really because of time, let me get to the last. It has to do with their impressions and I guess their belief as to the viability of the manner of government in which the Chinese live under. I mean, I view it as someone who's not been there, but nonetheless, an historian of sorts, as a totalitarian government where the government supersedes any concept of human right or a spiritual consideration. Is that what our world is going to be like in the future? And then I do have a follow-up to that relative to capitalism.
All right, Doris.
What the Chinese government is looking for is stability and harmony. They seek this as the basis to have a sustainable society in China. And we believe that the Chinese system, what we call a vertical democracy, where the government sets, gives directions, and the bottom, the people, have initiatives, that this is in a maturing process. When we look at China, let's not forget that democracy in America was created about 200 years ago. And look where we are now. But also look back where how things were 50, 60 years in the U.S. when there were riots and blacks couldn't vote and all of that. So we judge China as if it had all this time to mature. But China is not yet there. It is still in the maturing process. And many things that we criticize and that we are justified, will change over time. And I would say in one sentence, what the Chinese ideal is from the people and from the government is people who trust the government and the government who trust the people. And if that balance, to reach that balance, that's the goal, and it's a long way to go.
And your quick follow-up, John Old.
Okay. Relative to the capitalism, I could go in many areas, but to point, it seems like you guys are indicating that private enterprise will direct which way the government goes. Is that true? I mean, is it really going to be just another form of elected
government? I think private sector is. I mean, it might surprise Donald to know that the Chinese economy is today 70% private sector right now as we sit here. That's going to continue to take over the country, and it's more a capitalist country than it is a communist country, for sure.
Well, it's a fascinating view from John and Doris Nesbitt, who've lived in China for the last 10 years. Their new book is titled China's Megatrends, The Eight Pillars of a New Society. Thanks for being here. Good luck to you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. It's great to be with you.
Thank you. And thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR.